CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 54 with Bill Wiley, a passion for training the next generation of cataract refractive surgeons in the full spectrum of refractive surgery. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today we have an amazing refractive and cataract surgeon, Dr. Bill Wiley from Cleveland, Ohio, here in the USA. I've known Bill, and actually before that, even your dad, when he was in practice with you, for gosh, it's been at least two decades. Hence, we both have a good amount of gray hair. We're going to talk about a lot of things, like the future of what is coming in refractive surgery, and also how you can get your skills up to game so you're ready to go, and stuff you may not learn in residency. So, Bill, welcome to our podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Udi. You know, huge honor to be on the podcast with you. I love all the stuff you're putting out there, and as we're discussing, the amount of work you've put and the amount of content you've put out there is just amazing, and I always learn from you, and all my fellows always learn from you, and the young docs have so many good things to say. So thanks for what you do for our field. It's so cool to be on this podcast with you.
No, of course, we're all learning together. In fact, I've been a big fan of, you have a whole new series on Instagram that I find so useful. So tell me a little bit about that. How'd you get started, and what's your kind of goal with the Instagram?
Yeah, you know, so with Instagram, you know, what I've realized is, you know, it started with working with some of the young docs that are on my team. We have this fellowship that we're, you know, sort of a mentorship fellowship. We're teaching docs refractive and cataract surgery. And what I've realized is, you know, we've had now 8 fellows, and every year, you know, I find myself teaching the same things over and over, maybe something simple like a capsular rexus or a chopping technique or whatever it might be. And every year we kind of start from scratch and teach them the same things. I'm thinking to myself, you know what, should we have some kind of library of content to put this out there? And I, you know, learn from you sort of, you know, all my fellows, you'll watch what you do in Cataract Coach, and you've been such a great teacher. And I thought to myself, you know what, I should start to build this library. And if at the very least, just the fellows in my program watch it, I'm winning. But if anybody else can learn from it, that, you know, that's great as well. So if, you know, if a young fellow has watched all the content that's out there and joins our team, they're going to be that much further ahead if they've practiced it within the residency. And so in my mind, it's just kind of helping raise that bar for skill sets that are out there, and then the next fellow is going to kind of build on that and build on that. And, you know, I also learn, and I don't know if you're like this, if you can teach something, it makes you that much better at what you do. You know, it's one thing to do it, but then to kind of break it down into steps, you're like, okay, well, why do I do it this way, or why do I do a chop this way? For sure. And then when you break it down, you're like, oh, wait a minute, now that's made me a better surgeon, but also I've hopefully raised the bar for other docs that are out there trying to learn the same thing.
Yeah, you have to absolutely master something to be able to teach it. And yeah. I'm like you, the more I make a video, I'll learn a lot about it. So I'll kind of do a little extra homework to make sure I'm saying anything wrong.
Yeah.
So I learn more than I teach. I'm like, I'm absorbing all the good stuff.
Yeah. It's amazing. Exactly. I've thought about it over the years, and yeah, I've become, I thought I was pretty good already, but over the past 7-8 years, I've gotten that much better as a surgeon. You know, sometimes people ask me, they'll say, you know what, you know, Dr. Wiley, how long would it take to become, let's say, a world-class LASIK surgeon? And I say, you know what, I could probably get you to become world-class within maybe 4, 5, 6 months, maybe a year, something like that. And I said, okay, well, what about a cataract surgeon? How long does it become? Did it take to become a world-class cataract surgeon? I usually answer, I said, you know what? I'll tell you when I get there.
And, right.
Yeah. You know, because, you know, right. You know, we're always trying. It's like you think you're good, and then you there's another level. And so you try to raise it up.
You know, yeah. I always say cataract surgery, it'll take you many years to learn it and a lifetime to master it.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree. Totally agree.
Yeah, it's anything. And yeah, I mean, we pick up so many more pearls. I think the cell phone has really changed the way that we're learning.
Yeah.
And so you learn so much. I mean, I learn best visually. I think all ophthalmologists do, and we're in the field.
Yes.
But to be able to watch just a little bit of a video every day, just pick up pearls here and there. It's just, wow, the learning is just immense. And that little bit of learning over the course of a year, amazing.
Totally agree. You're right. And you think back to when we first learned, you know, cataract surgery, you know, you might have had like a VHS tape and plugged in a VCR and watched that. And that was, you know, pretty good, but you could only, yeah, I don't know. It's sort of a production to put something on the TV to watch it. And then even you would say, okay, well, I'm going to go to a meeting and watch somebody teach something. And you know, you might go to a meeting once or twice a year, Academy or ASCRS or whatever it might be, maybe a special meeting, Caribbean Eye. You obviously, you know, I'm biased towards that meeting. It's a meeting I've been going to a long time, but you learn a little bit, but it's broken out. But now on a cell phone, literally it's right there at your fingertips. And you can learn that much faster. And I'm curious, I don't know if you've gotten the new Apple Vision Pro, but I'm wondering with that type of device, are we going to be that much more immersed? You know, my son and I got one and we've been messing around with it. And just, I can only imagine if we can sort of immerse ourselves that much more into, let's say, 3D cataract surgery, and it might feel like we're actually there in the room. I don't know if that's going to be the case or not, but they're going to, you know, again, one more level up of digital, you know, peer education.
Yeah, I have not tried it yet. I mean, I've seen like the thing online about it.
Yes.
I'd certainly love to check it out. But yeah, I think the most common, I track all this. So I had a few 3D videos I featured on Cataract Coach, but the views were really low. And it's kind of like 3D TVs at home. Like, you know, 10 years ago, I'd go to Costco or Best Buy and it's all 3D TVs. And now they're literally zero. If I go to Costco now, they don't sell a single 3D TV.
That's interesting. You're right. You know, it's funny you say that. I, you know, working with the guys over at True Vision that ultimately then transitioned into Ingenuity, they were talking about when they built it, initially they can get off the shelf 3D TVs at Best Buy for a couple $1,000 and it would go with their system. And towards the tail end, they were like, well, you know what? They no longer make 3D TVs. And I think they had to like actually produce them, you know, work with a factory and have these custom made. And now some became like $20,000 to get a TV set because they were the only ones making it. And it's interesting, just sort of the commercial market that's out there, you know, consumer market versus commercial market. And it's just interesting how, you know, this divergence and intertwining, and obviously, you know, the cell phone, it's going to be hard to beat what we can see on these, you know.
Right. Get convenience too.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Like while I may make my videos on a desktop or a laptop, I think they're consumed. I track all this. They're consumed way more than half on mobile devices. So cell phones and tablets are kind of looped together in the demo.
Yeah.
Yeah, but desktops, laptops are a smaller percentage.
That's so interesting. Now, so you're tracking, you can see, you know, where, you know, basically where these, you know, devices are, you know, how they're being, you know, how your content's being consumed.
So you can track all that stuff. Plus, you know, the question is, do you do landscape mode or are you doing portrait mode? And so, if it's a lot of it's in your hand, a lot of Instagram is always portrait mode, not landscape mode. But YouTube is landscape mode. I'm kind of biased towards landscape mode because that's how we record the videos in the first place.
That's interesting. And then sort of probably depending who the target audience is and how, you know, are you seeing more people on YouTube or more people on Instagram? Or it probably depends on the content too. Is it a, you know, 90-second pearl, or is it a 5-minute case or discussion? You know, I mean, it's probably, or are you kind of bouncing back?
Yeah, for Cataract Coach, I put up a full 5-minute plus video every single day. And then what I do, I copy a clip of that, maybe half of it to Instagram for the Instagram account.
Yes.
And so, but then, yeah, I cross post on everything on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, cataractcoach.com, the website, on YouTube. It's all immediately done. And I do it the videos go out at 2 a.m. Pacific time, which is 5 a.m. East Coast time. So my East Coast surgeons can enjoy it in the morning when they're having their coffee or their commute to work or whatever.
That's awesome. That's so cool. And how far ahead are you producing? Let's say do you have a calendar and are you keyed up for next week already? Or are you
weeks
in advance or days in advance or months in advance? Typically.
No. So months in advance is tough because I want to stay current.
Right.
But one of the neat things with the way we do things now is, honestly, I'm not a huge fan of putting stuff in the old peer-reviewed journals anymore. And the reason is, yes, it's respected and this, but that's kind of old school. You know how, if I put a video up of me operating tomorrow, 5,000 ophthalmologists will peer review it the same day.
Yes. It's amazing. You're right. We've seen this transition. And I suppose all this, I don't know what your thoughts are. Are we seeing the media, is it sort of additive to what's already been built or is it replacing? When I say that, so you have old school peer review, and if you think of an idea and gather the data, it might be a year before it gets into print. And then you have, let's say, a meeting, like Academy Area CRS, there's some peer reviewing going on there. It might take 6 months to get it out there. Caribbean Eye, let's call it 3 months. And then maybe a throwaway journal like CRST or iWorld or something like that. Maybe it's a month or two, but Instagram is the day or the minute. And so do you think that all this, the newer stuff, is it replacing all, let's say, peer review going all the way back to the beginning? Or is it just sort of additive? Like you need these other, and this is just more to support. Is it just the pie getting bigger or is it, or is it taking away pieces of the other pie? If you had to guess, I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
That's a great question. And so I think it is a little bit of a shift, especially now, because I know in my own clinic, for the trade journals that come on my desk, actually my staff just throws them away.
Yeah.
So I don't actually read them. And even the ones, like I have a monthly column on Ocular Surgery News, even the one that has my picture on the, they're throwing it away. I'm not saving any of them. Because how much can I save, right? It's too much. So I hardly ever look at the trade journals that come on my desk. Everything's only consumed for me online, desktop, laptop, or cell phone or tablet. That's how it's done. And I think, but I even was a fan of this 20 years ago in 2004, when the 25 gauge vitrectomy systems first came out. I actually had an idea that I did with our pediatric ophthalmologist. We were both attending level, junior attendings, young guys. Me and Federico Velez, who's a fantastic peds person in LA, we decided to use 25 gauge vitrectomy to do a baby lensectomy.
No way.
Because back in the day, the babies with congenital cataracts, they were making these nonsense huge incisions. I mean, these are minuscule eyes. These are like 9 millimeter white to whites. So we did the whole thing 25 gauge, because we leave them afakic, right, for the first year or so of life.
Yeah.
And they were in the contact that changes every month. So I wanted it out there immediately. So what I did was I got it published as my column in OSN, Ocular Surgery News, the next month. So beat everyone to the punch. Yes, it's not peer reviewed and this and that, but at least it's there and it's documented that it was done at that time. So I think videos now replace that.
And right. So it's that much quicker. Yeah.
Right. Just that much quicker. And I think now the key in all this stuff is just to make sure that it's in, you can index it and search it. And one of the catches and the problems with Instagram is, if you do a Google search, how many Instagram results does Google pull up? Very, very few. But since Google owns YouTube, a ton, if you put it on YouTube, it's always prioritized in a Google search.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you've got to make sure you've got that, sort of redundancy. And so you want it to hit, I suppose both, and they're both serving a purpose, is you're getting into as younger docs, or I guess every doc now is sort of getting their daily feed on their Instagram, but also the indexing when you do a Google, and if obviously you have memberships where if you're a membership, you're going to get lit up that, there's a new video that dropped, Cataract Coach. And so there's a lot of different ways to get that out there. But I think, you're definitely touching, I started seeing some of the shift change when people talk about, a lot of times it would be even industry reps would come in. They'd say, hey, did you see the new video? Uday's new video or Paul Singh's new video or maybe Morgan Micheletti. These are a few people that are kind of putting video out there. And it was interesting. And I would be like, no, like what is this on? Or were they talking? What medium? And it was interesting. I was like, well, gosh, it used to be, did you see the new you know, issue that came out that, you know, OSN or whatever it might be, and that, you know, dropped in there. And it's like, okay, I'd look at that. But now industry is pushing, you know, this content because they realize, you know, it's the best way for the for docs to learn, and it's or the current way currently. And so I sort of realized, I'm like, gosh, if I want to be relevant or stay relevant, you know, I've got things to say and I've got techniques to put out there, fellows to train or whatever it might be. And right. This is going to be my, you know, I better get involved, you know.
Right. I think the same way. And then again, it's just putting out so much good information there. So I've created a whole bunch of stuff, not only a video every day now for 2,100 something.
Amazing. Days. So awesome. Yeah.
But now obviously the podcast is going now. We're about a year into it, which is fantastic. And the podcast is just growing very rapidly. But I also have a free cataract coach PDF book about learning cataract surgery. Forget buying a book anymore. It's a PDF file. Download it, send it to your friends. It's free. Share it with everyone. I don't mind. And then I also have a 25-part curriculum series. So 40-minute videos about lesson one, preparing mentally for the operating room, lesson two, and ergonomics, setting up the patient. I got a whole lesson about different types of anesthesia, whether it's a topical or intracameral, subtenous block, or retrobulbar block, perivulbar. I have videos for all that stuff. So I have a complete 25-part curriculum series, which if you do a video that's longer, 40 minutes, a video every week, you get that done in 25 weeks or 6 months, or you do it every other week, get it done in a year. And so that's awesome. I put all that out there free too.
Yeah. So Uday, when do you sleep? Yeah.
Well, it's just, you know, it's a ton of work. You got to be driven. You got to be motivated to do it. But yeah, my videos, I'm about a month ahead in the queue. I keep them in a queue. Again, I don't want to be too much more than that, because then if someone sends me a great video, well, I can't put it up, but I already have them all lined up for the next 2 months, 3 months. That's too much.
Got it. So you got to juggle. Maybe you're a month ahead, but you might move things around or shift it or something.
Right. And then even though this is all digital, all this, some old habits die hard. You know what that is? Gown card, right?
Yeah.
List of videos that I'm for the month that I'm doing.
No way. I love that. I love when people reuse it. You know, gown card. You know, I had some OR staffs like collect those and they have it. They're like, okay, this is what I use for notes around the house or whatever it might be. I love it.
Right. So I use these to make a list of like here. I don't give it to, but those like here, some of the February videos already done. Like, there you go.
No way. Okay. Yeah. There's some secret sauce. I love it. Yeah.
I put a little checkbox there when I got an upload. I'm obviously you can do it all digital, but like, you know, that's something I picked up in med school 30 years ago.
That's so cool.
Yeah. But a month in advance is probably the sweet spot for me. And then also allows me to be able to travel.
Yeah.
Like I can go to a meeting. I did 12 countries last year. So I really get making the rounds on the traveling for ophthalmology.
Oh my gosh.
Right. Yeah. It's, yeah, it's a ton. It's a ton. Yeah. But it's amazing to go see people. And well, I'm just so flattered when people, I literally take at every meeting, I take hundreds of selfies and I'm so honored.
And I've witnessed that. You're not just saying, I've been at meetings with you and I've seen, you know, I sat next, you know, I just like, if I happen to be on podium near you, I know I'm going to get some shrapnel. There's this sort of, there's going to be some spillover, you know, like, you know, I might get tagged in some, pictures with Uday, but I've seen the docs. And it's interesting. It's a lot of the young docs, because that's who's, you know, really in this medium. Right. And I've seen people come up, get your autograph, the whole thing. So,
it's, you know, fun.
Yeah. So
yeah, it's really fun. You know, I mean, I'm happy that my family's always thought I was a little crazy. Like, why are you so into this one surgery? Why are you cuckoo for cataracts? I said, well, this is what I love.
Yeah.
I just love this surgery. Yeah. And so now it's like, I'm so happy that other people share that passion and like, oh my gosh, they want to learn from these videos. I'm honored.
Yeah. That's so cool. That's cool. Yeah.
And the neat thing is like, we can get things that are fresh and new and like, you know, Sergio Canabrava is an amazing surgeon from Brazil. Has a way of doing his Canabrava technique of basically kind of suspending a lens with proline and flanges and all that. So he just sent me an updated new version. He's got a revision to it. I'm like, sweet. I'm happy to put up a cataract coach. And the amazing part is in the first day, it'll get 5,000 views.
It's like, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah. And so just disseminates that information so that he can let everyone know, hey, here's the new way I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Really, it's just, I think, and even though we do skew younger, I think majority of my audience is, let's say, under age 50, surgeons under age 50.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised that a lot of surgeons over age 50. who watched my stuff. I just interviewed for a podcast. The podcast just recently is Johnny Gayton. Johnny Gayton is such an incredible man.
I love that guy.
Yeah, I love him. Incredible. So, but he was like, he watches all my videos. He's I'm honored.
That's so,
him, right? That's he invented like piggyback lens and you know, IOLs to treat narrow angles. I mean, like,
His studies, you know, on piggyback lens, you know, we still reference him. We just published something. Arjun Hura, who's out in your neck of the woods, did a series on piggyback lenses at our office and looking at acrylic on acrylic and sort of, you know, debunking some of the myths that were out there. And I said, well, just, you know, look up for the references, look up Johnny Guyton. And he had, you know, article after article, and basically helped, you know, create that, that space and, you know, did a lot of heavy lifting there.
Now I know it's a side tangent, but you got to tell me what were the secret findings or the myths that were debunked?
So here's the thing. So what's interesting, there's been a myth, and I think it was built on some truth, but that you can't put acrylic on top of acrylic in a piggyback formation. But we've been doing that for years. We had about a 30-eye case series that we tracked with acrylic in the sulcus on top of an acrylic that's in the bag. And the key is, as long as you have one in the bag and one in the sulcus, you're okay. It's sort of, if you put acrylic and acrylic in the bag, you're going to get interlenticular fibrosis. That's really hard to treat because you can't yag it. It gets trapped in between the lenses. But if you have one lens in the bag and one in the sulcus, in particular, you need a certain lens in the sulcus. We use the AR40 that has rounded edges, so it's not irritating the iris, not causing this inflammation. So if you have rounded edge optic with proline haptic in the sulcus, you tend to do okay. So I think a lot of people were afraid to put that acrylic in the sulcus. They're like, oh, we're gonna have a problem. But it was based on sort of data that was both lenses in the bag. So anyways, a little side note. So now people should feel comfortable putting the acrylic lens. Where it all started was, you know, Star used to make a great lens that went into the sulcus. Everybody used it, and then they discontinued it. And Star's lens was silicone or Collamer, one of the two. Anyways, and then when that went off the market, people are like, okay, well, now what are you using for piggyback? And they're afraid to use the acrylic, but actually you can if it's in the sulcus.
Yeah, I'm with you. Bring back the Star AQ2010.
Yeah, that's right. I can't remember the model number. Yeah.
That was an awesome lens. Yeah, because it's a little bit bigger. Overall, haptic lens is a little longer, and then the optic thing was like 6.3 or something, so a little bit bigger.
So, it was forgiving. It would cover that old, you know, the base lens, no problem.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool stuff. So, you know, speaking of it, so this is a study you did with a former fellow. You've got an amazing fellowship that we definitely got to talk about. Your fellowship is, I think, it's a refractive surgery fellowship that is really incredible volume, incredible teaching. Tell me about it.
Thanks, Udi. Yeah, so it's interesting. It actually, you know, it seems to have this driving force. We train surgeons in Ohio, and they go to California.
They're all here.
So actually, yes, yeah, so I know if you're in your backyard, but actually, so it started with Amir Marathi, who's out in LA and great doc. And he was training here in Ohio at Case Western. And I work with some of the residents over there. And so one day he said, hey, Dr. Wiley, can I come by and just see what you're doing in clinic and in private clinic? I said, yeah, no problem. Come anytime. So he comes in and you take it for granted. As you know, and academics often runs at a little bit different pace, and they have, you know, maybe some different priorities than what a private practice cataract refractive practice is doing. So he came in, he's like, oh my gosh, he's like seeing a lot of cool and innovative stuff that we're sort of taking for granted. And he said, you know, Dr. Wiley, this is like been the greatest day I've had in ophthalmology. I think he was buttering him up a little bit, but he gives me a big hug and, you know, hugs me at the beginning of the day and hugs me at the end of the day. If you know Amir, he's a big hugger, he hugs everybody. And so he's like, you know, would you at all be interested in doing a fellowship? I'd love to train under you for a year. And we had been thinking about it, but it's so hard to find that first fellow because the first one is critical. If they're not into it, or if they don't have a good experience, then you're not going to get that next one or the next one. So he was very highly motivated, and we were already sort of thinking about having the fellowship. And So we said, okay, yeah, Amir, we'll take you on. So he was psyched. And then the next year he did a great job of telling friends out there and said, you know, this is a great fellowship that you're going to learn a lot. And it's relatively high volume. And then it sort of grew from there, but we do have your sort of a philosophy. Yeah. I sort of took it back to how did I learn? And there's a few different ways people learn. And there's a lot of different ways. I tell docs, you know, you should sort of find a mentor that is like style where you're going to learn and maybe more didactic and, you know, in the classroom and more academic. I say, okay, great. Go that path. Or some people say, you know what? I need hands-on. I need, you know, surgical. Yes, exactly. And say, okay. And that's how I learned when I trained under my father. I didn't do a formal fellowship per se. I joined my dad and he did more of a mentorship and he said, okay, Bill, you know, the goal is, he just thought, he's like, if you can do 1,000 procedures in a year, by the end of that year, you're going to have, you know, near expertise in that procedure. Almost that, I'm going to blank on the, it's Malcolm, is it Gladwell, the author that wrote the book Blink, but, talked about becoming an expert, you know, the speed of doing that, volume is if you can get to 1,000 of a certain, you know, technique, you're going to be that much further ahead. So he said, okay, if you can do 1,000 cataracts and 1,000 LASIK in your first year with me, Bill, I think you can then help take over the practice and I can retire quicker. He is highly motivated to retire. So he basically, so I said, okay. And it worked, that worked for me. I sort of fast tracked my, you know, professional career, you know, in our practice and said, okay, if I have a fellowship, that's going to be my goal to have, you know, more or less 1,000, you know, lens-based procedures and 1,000 corneal refractive-based procedures. And we've sort of held true to that. And
that's a dang good clip. That's like 20 LASIK and 20 IOLs a week. For a fellow. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's been sort of the goal. And so, you know, docs that then want, you know, our goal, you know, I think, you know, residency, I look at residency, it's so you can become competent in doing a certain, you know, let's say competent in doing retina lasers. We all learned how to do that, or competent in doing cataract surgery, whatever it might be. But a fellowship, no matter what path you're doing, you know, retina or peds or glaucoma, whatever it is, the goal should be to become near expertise in that area. And so hopefully upon graduating a fellowship, you can go to nearly any town, you know, and become one of the best in that town at what you do. Or docs might be like, hey, I'm going to refer to this guy, even though they might be only a year or two out, they become good at that. And so, you know, as you've probably seen, it seems like, you know, refractive surgery today, you know, we have so many. When I came out, we just had LASIK and PRK and that was it. And now we have, you know, ICLs and corneal cross-linking and CTAC and INTACs and, you know, presbyopic lenses and torque lenses and EDOF lenses and light adjustable lenses and all these different things, smile. And, you know, it's hard to be good at all those. You know, we've learned it, you and I, over 20 some years or more. Yeah. But now if you want to come out of residency to be good, it takes time, you know, it takes volume and experience. And so we're hopefully trying to have this, you know, and there's a number of other practices like this that are doing these type of, you know, fellowships where you're trying to learn all the modern techniques within a relatively short period of time. Maybe some are 2 years, some are 1 year, but anyways, that's our goal.
So a fellowship sounds amazing. And I think that's kind of the trend. I had on the podcast, Guy Kazarian, great episode, by the way, who's head of the Refractive Surgery Alliance.
Yes.
And he's explaining how there's so many now programs where there are doctors like you in these busy, busy practices who are setting up these fellowships that are unlike anything else like academic ophthalmology has ever seen.
Yes.
And it really is for refractive surgery, kind of breaking out into finally its own subspecialty.
Totally agree. And I think, yeah, Guy has done a great job, another great educator and networker and collaborator. He's got so many cool projects out there. Physician CEO. I actually took that a few years ago and had a great experience. And and so Guy, the RSA is, you know, a great resource for young or any refractive surgeon, but they do have a great fellowship track. And like you said, it is different. I think I some people, I want to be careful, but I don't want to be you know, competitive necessarily with academic centers. I think it's just a different path. And I often, when residents ask me, they say, you know, doc, what would be, should I do more an academic fellowship or private practice fellowship? And my typical recommendation would be to say, try to envision your ideal sort of work life in 10 years. And I say, if you are 15 years, if your path, if you think of the perfect setup is to be, let's say, chairman of an ophthalmology department at XYZ Academic Center, I said, to be honest, your best path to get to that chairmanship is likely to go through an academic fellowship, understand the hierarchy, understand the different specialties and subspecialties, how they work, how the hospital system works, all the politics, the whole strategy there. I said, you got to go that path. I don't think taking a Wiley-Bothna fellowship is going to help you. It wouldn't. I mean, maybe you go with us, but not likely the straightest path to get to your goal. I said, but if you sort of envision, you know what, I want to be in a cataract refractive private practice setting, you know, either, you know, smaller practice or, you know, small group practice with a focused sort of directive on this type of practice style, I think a private practice fellowship is that stepping stone. You get to see, right, how does the staff work? How does the administrative work? How do they interface with industry? All those things. So you sort of almost have to take a step back and envision, where do you want to go? And then a fellowship like ours could be a great stepping stone to get to that future goal.
Right. Now, what are some of the challenges? You get someone who finished residency and maybe a very good residency who's done 200-ish cataracts during residency, but never once did 20 today. Because I know when I taught residents at the county hospital, when I first started teaching there, it was 4 or 5 cataracts for the whole day. And at best, what I was able to achieve by the end, very routinely, we could get 10 cataracts done in 8 hours, which for the county hospital was pretty good, especially with trainee doctors. But so at most, you're going to get someone who's finished residency and at most did, let's say, 10 cataracts in a day. And all of a sudden now they got to do double that volume. How do you get them up to speed?
Yeah. So, and I think some people are intimidated by that perspective, and they think, gosh, I don't think I can do or I want to do that. And so, you know, it's easy. I think anybody has that aptitude if they want to do it, let's say, but we start slow and break it down literally step by step. And I more or less look at, you know, even a surgeon, maybe nowadays, you know, back when I was coming out of residency, if I did 180 cataracts, that was a lot. That was like a busy residency. And they said, now there's some doing 300-400 cases, but I'll be honest, even those high volume residencies, I pretty much assume they're starting from scratch for cataract surgery. Like literally the style, I want to just break it down and say, okay, you've pretty much haven't done any. I'm going to break it down, even putting the lid speculum in or draping the patient. I said, okay, let's break, like, you know, when we're doing the drape, I'm like, okay, switch. That's not quite right. Go back in, readjust it. The lid speculum, get that step. And we go, you know, more or less step by step and breaking it down. And so we start with maybe just the incision, and it's just, okay, the incision, and then, you know, stop and I'll take over. And then we usually start from the beginning of the case and the end of the case and kind of work towards the middle. So maybe you work at the incision, get that down, and at the end of the case, injecting the lens and then doing INA, relatively straightforward. I would say the most challenging part and the most risky part is actually nuclear disassembly, you know, the crack or phaco. So we sort of start at the beginning and the end and work towards that middle. And even when we, you know, get to that middle section, let's say nuclear cracking, maybe I'll chop the nucleus into, you know, 4, 5, 6 pieces and then switch and say, now you can remove them. You get used to the phaco settings, get used to the system, get used to maybe ingenuity, seeing 3D, and then eventually you start getting through that. And I tell, you know, the team, you know, it might be a couple months before they've even done one cataract with us, and they think, well, and then they start thinking, they're like, well, all those like little incisions and stuff like that, does that count towards my case count? I said, no, until you've actually phacoed and removed the nucleus or phaco, don't count any of those cases. They're like, oh my gosh, so now we're 2 or 3 months in, and now you're saying I'm still going to finish with 1,000 cases. How's this going to go? But eventually, you know, you have to get all those steps right before you can, you know, feel confident with nuclear disassembly. And then finally, we work on that. And different fellows will move through that sort of timeline, you know, at different paces, but more or less, I know, you know, we're highly motivated to get them through that, you know, through that sort of learning curve.
How about dealing with patients? Because it's a different setting in that most people who do their training, you're doing it in an academic center, or let's say a county hospital or a VA hospital. Yes. And now you're in like an elective, you know, high-end private practice. How do you?
Well, yeah. So there's functionally no room for error. And so, you know, our philosophy is, you know, we have to be delivering better care with two doctors than one. And so, you know, initially my partner and I was saying, you know, as you know, you with a private practice setting, you have a high expectation. You have to deliver on that. And you know, patients, you know, any patient has a high demand regardless of where you are, but somehow in private practice, it seems like the stakes are higher. There's some competition out there. So there's a number of people out there that are available to do the same thing you do. So our philosophy is sort of, let's say flying an airplane, you know, two pilots are better than one. And so you have a pilot and co-pilot, and those pilot and co-pilot are doing different, you know, things throughout the, throughout that trip, but having those two on board that plane is going to allow for safer, better, you know, more accurate, you know, flight. And so we have that same philosophy. So we have two people working with the patient, two people looking at the chart, two people studying, you know, watching the video, making sure everything's going perfect. So working hand in hand and, you know, assuring that everything's going to go perfect. So we've sort of raised the bar and have better outcomes with this team approach than we would with just a solo, you know.
Oh, I love the idea. I love the concept of the pilot and co-pilot. It makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So it seems to work out. So, but it is, I would say that even today we're better teachers today than we were when we first started. It's just like, I'm sure your first few videos on Cataract Coach were, you know, were probably good, but the ones you put out now, like, you know how to break it down. You know how to, you know, it's an art to be able to teach something, and it takes, you know, it just takes time to even learn how to teach. So,
For sure. Another challenge, like you were saying, in basketball, if you shoot 90% from the free throw line, you're pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, I shoot 90% in cataract surgery. You're a disaster.
Disaster. So you're
right. Even 99 is like, no, it's not good enough.
Right. The stakes are so high. Yes.
Right. It's so amazing. I mean, just if you think of the standard that we hold ourselves to, which is basically 100%.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It is. You're right. And it's, you know, and I think other fields of medicine have different standards. If you look at, let's say, you know, even OBGYN, it's a very challenging field because there are real complications that happen at real percentages. Right. I think the complication rate is, you know, way higher with those types of surgeries than we have with, you know, thankfully with cataract surgery. In general, in good hands, the complication rate is so small, but it's not to say that it's easy. It just, there's just no room for error. We've just held it to a higher standard, I suppose, with the patient.
Right. And, you know, someone has surgery on a different part of the body. They're not going to see the surgery or maybe not know its effect so much. If I had a shoulder repaired, like, okay, it's pretty good. I don't know the difference, but for the vision, I see this every day, whether it's my LASIK or my cataract. I mean, this is like, wow, the stakes are so high. You know, it's tough to teach all this, but I mean, you obviously do a fantastic job. That's really neat. But now for your fellows, they go out and obviously do practice and very successful. You've got to recruit your fellows to help you create like an online curriculum for this stuff. Put all the, you have so much good stuff to put it on together, all together in a proper curriculum. It'd be amazing.
I know. I feel like we do have some work to do. I got to take a page out of your book and work on that and get better at putting the content out there, you know, because you know, we video so many cases. We have so many things that, you know, have drawers of hard drives that are sitting there. Right. I'm like, okay, I got to break that down and really, you know, analyze it and edit it and put it out there. But, that'll be
you got so much great stuff to teach, but well, I'm really impressed with that fellowship. It just sounds like you're training them right. Just the way you approach it, the two pilot method, the kind of bookending them into cataract surgery, which I thought was neat. than getting them such high volume and really teaching them the intricacies of how the whole practice runs. I think that's really, I mean, I wish I did your fellowship 20 some years ago. It's
so high yield. Yeah. Well, see, yeah. I mean, you should now, have you thought about doing it yourself? You know, have you thought about having,
I'll be your fellow anytime you want. I'm pretty good. You'd be surprised. You'd be like, man, he can suck out a cataract fast, clean, safe, beautiful.
Yeah, I think I could just take like a year sabbatical. You know, if you came on board, I would just, you know, take a year off and
come back. No, you know, see, I did teach resin for a long time, from 2000 to 2022. So I taught.
Oh no!
I taught 10,000 resin cases.
And I got so, that's where some of the gray hairs came from. I see.
Yeah. I love it. I love teaching residents, but it was time to move on, pass the baton. Yeah. So I stopped doing that in 2022, but I do have a new project in the works, and hopefully later this year, I'll be back teaching residents, but at a different kind of setup.
So, oh, really? I look forward to it. Yeah. Keep me updated. Yeah. Yeah. Happy to, you know, discuss or download any other thoughts on the whole process, if I can be of any help, but.
Yeah, I'm sure. Really neat. I mean, you know, probably one of my favorite things of teaching residents was like, being in touch with them years, decades later, and so proud of what they accomplished. Like, I go out of my way to help them, like, you know, succeed in life. And
that's so cool.
It's that camaraderie means a lot. I mean,
Yeah. You see some of the people, you know, like, that have done a really good job. You look at, let's say, Dick Lindstrom, who had the Lindstrom Fellowship, and you see, it's so crazy to think that we could name, between you and I, we could probably name 20 of them just off the cuff. And like the impact that each one of those individuals had on the field is amazing, let alone all of them, let alone just all having a mentor like, you know, Dick Lindstrom. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, real frustrating. He's one of the godfathers. I mean, he was my podcast number two. My podcast number one was Osher. Number two was Lindstrom. I mean, these guys are obviously amazing. Huge impact on all of our careers. So it's really, really a neat thing. But we all end up learning together, and those guys are obviously very, very passionate.
Yeah.
Where do you see the future of refractive cataract surgery? What's coming down the road for us? You're always in the forefront. You work with a lot of companies. You have a lot of the latest technology. You're probably the biggest gadget guy out there. What's coming next?
So what's coming next? You know what? It's interesting. I think I think accommodative lenses might be, it might have a resurgence. I know, that's what started all the premium, you know, with the crystal lens. And, you know, I think that, you know, paved the way. But for the whole premium channel, guys like Andy Corley that sort of invented this space, that, you know, probably without that, you and I wouldn't even be talking right now. You know, our field, I think, would be in so much trouble. It's just hard to imagine where we'd be without that innovation cycle that was just infused.
For the young doctors who may not know, Andy Corley was with a company called Ionix that made the crystal lens. And at the time, there were basically three of these presbyopic lenses. One was crystal lens from Ionix, which is then sold to Bausch & Lomb. One was a multifocal from Alcon, the Restore 4.0. So it was a bifocal with a 4 diopter on the IOL ad, which is maybe like 3.2 diopters, a spectacle plane ad. And then there was from at the time, AMO, which was American Medical Optics, then became Advanced Medical Optics, then became Abbott Medical Optics, and now was sold to Johnson & Johnson. That company had, what was their lens? The Array. They had, then they had the Resume.
That's right.
Resume was a refractive, not a diffractive multifocal. So those are the three lenses. And so what ended up happening was Andy Corley and some very smart people basically petitioned CMS, the Center for Medicare Services, to say, can we allow patients to pay out of pocket for these devices and the associated surgeon fees for that? And in May of 2005, they were successful in getting that done. And that has changed. That's 19 years ago. Wow. That has changed our practice forever. So we're obviously eternally grateful.
Yeah, it's amazing. You're right. It's crazy. We're coming up. We'll be coming up on 20 years. We should celebrate that and acknowledge that. It's a big milestone because that 20 years of innovation, without that, we would have had capitated reimbursement. And so nobody would want to invent any of this new stuff. Nobody would want to have a femtosecond laser to chop up a cataract because there's no money to pay for it. No one would want a new, you know, accommodating lens, multifocal lens, toric lens, any of this stuff because with a capitated system, there was no money to go around. So now with bounce billing, truly the sky's the limit. If you've invented X-ray lens, okay, fine. Someone will pay for that. And there's an ability to do that. So, so that innovation, you know, is really helped pave the way. So anyway, so what's the new thing? I think accommodative lenses may come back. There's a cool lens, Jealousy that looks like it has, great accommodation from a doc that was actually here in Cleveland, a pediatric ophthalmologist, Jim Ellis, that saw, you know, why could a kid's lens accommodate 10 diopters when they're young? And could we with a new compliant material allowed to have that happen, with modern day technology? So that looks cool. There's another lens called the Atia lens. It's a modular design that looks cool. So maybe we'll see something like that. There's,
you got the Lens Gen Juvine too. That's the one that I'm involved in.
Oh, nice. Yes. And the Juvine, I always get that one mixed up. So, you know, is that with Ram Rao?
Yes. Lens Gen, you got it.
Yeah.
What's interesting is, like, it just takes so long though. I did the first human implantations of the Juvine ever. I did it in 2015.
No way. I didn't realize that. Oh, no way. Oh, that's
awesome. Then I did a bunch more later on in Monterey, Mexico. And obviously they're now starting FDA trials, but it's like 9 years later.
Yes, it is. It's some heavy arduous. So that's cool. Well, thanks, Uday, for heavy lifting in the early stages. That's where a lot of that stuff happens. So you have all those things, which looks cool. There's a small startup, but you know, that looks interesting, called OnPoint, that has a piggyback style that actually the piggyback clips onto the natural lens. So in theory, you could clip on a multifocal or clip on a toric lens or clip on, what's also cool, they have a high ad clip on that you could do a magnifier for macular degeneration. So clip on a plus 10 for
as all the existing IOL.
Yeah. So it clips onto any IOL. That was started by Kevin Cady. That was, you might have known him. He was at Ionics a long time ago as a rep. I think he started as a rep and then moved his way up. Was at WaveTech for a bit. I think Star for a bit. Anyways, cool to see sort of kind of like an Andy Corley type. You know, Andy was, early lens rep that, you know, worked his way up to become CEO and you know, saw how the business worked. And so Kevin looks like he's taking a shot, and that looks very cool. I think what's also interesting is sort of adjustability. So the light adjustable lens is very cool. So to see what they might do with that technology, but exchangeability, you know, if we're going to have the ability. So I think it's going to be, I don't know, it's going to win. Is it going to be adjustability, exchangeability, one of those two things? But I think patients nowadays, it's sort of like when you have your iPhone, this is the iPhone 15. Well, they know that there's going to be an iPhone 20 coming out and they want to have the ability to have that. Why should they be locked in with a lens for lifetime? And so a lot, you've probably seen how many patients come in and say, you know what, I want to do something, but it seems so final to just be pick this lens. What happens? What if there's new tech? Can I get something new? So things like maybe the Omega capsule that allows for changeability, or some other, you know, some of those new lasers that can adjust actually the lens, that's, you know, any lens inside the eye with phase
shift. Refractive index shaping. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, is that going to be the future? So who knows? I think, you know, I guess the bottom line, is every time I remember when I first came out, my dad started LASIK surgery in 98 and I came out in 02 and he had done thousands of LASIK. And I'm like, I thought to myself, I legit thought this. I'm like, I think I missed the boat on refractive surgery. Everybody's had refractive surgery. There's going to be nobody left. And you can think that was 02 and think about all the innovation that's happened since 02 until now. And so we're, you know, docs coming out just now are probably thinking, you know what, I've missed the boat. There's all that, you know, everybody's had something and I there's nothing more we can do, but we're just, I think, scratching the tip of the iceberg. There's going to be another X many years of innovation ahead of us.
Absolutely. I think that's probably one of the best bits of advice I'd give to young ophthalmologists, is that do not worry about surgical volume. You will have plenty of volume. There's so much more need, and we are barely scratching the surface. If you look at the total amount, like in the US now, the incidence of myopia keeps going up and up and up because we're doing all this near work in these formative years. You see now kids in strollers, babies playing on an iPhone. You see kids who are, you know, single age, 8, 9, 10 years old, the whole day is on an iPad. It's crazy. Yes. And so as a result, they end up becoming myopic. So the incidence of myopia is super high now. And you'll get to some cities, people get Singapore and Hong Kong, where the incidence of myopia is like 80% or more among young people. And think about LASIK. What are we doing now? 600,000-700,000 LASIK for the country as a whole per year? I mean, this should be more ubiquitous. It should be like braces. You know, you turn 11, 12 years old, your teeth are a little bit crooked. Your parents get you some braces, your teeth become perfectly straight. It should be the same thing, kind of like, all right, you became myopic in your youth. Okay, somewhere around college age, right after college, just do your keratorefractive surgery, stabilize you. Now you're good to become presbyopic. When you become presbyopic at age 50, now you can do an eye well, restore your accommodate, and you're good for life.
Yes, totally agree. Yes.
I think we're going to get there for sure. So, yeah, I would never worry about surgical volume. There, I promise there is so much more volume out there than we can even handle.
Totally agree. You're right. I think it is interesting. I think in the older generations, you when cataract surgery, well, number one, there wasn't really refractive surgery, that was a very small amount. But then cataract surgery, I think there was in the late 90s, I think we had, 800,000 cataract surgeries done a year, maybe 600,000. And now I think next year it's projected 4 million or something like that. So it's almost like back then people got really competitive with each other. Like, oh my gosh, they're taking my cases. And now it's just sort of, and that's, you know, not to say there's not competition, but now it's more internal competition. Like, okay, how do I, you know, service the patients that are out there and give them the technology that they want? How do I educate them? It's more internal competition rather than external competition. It's a weird kind of shift, but in some regards, it makes, I think, us, you know, interact with more, you know, look at everybody more as colleagues and competitors. You know, I'm sure, I mean, you're in California, maybe it's probably a bit different out there, a little more competitive.
You're right. I only compete with myself.
Yeah.
I have plenty of colleagues, but I don't have any competition in LA because I'm not competing with them. I'm literally competing with myself. Every case I do, it's like, how perfect can I make it? How beautiful can I make this case? How accurate can I be? How safe can I be? What's the newest technology I can give to this patient? So yeah, I'm competing with myself, not someone else. So you're right. And there really is no issue with volume. I promise you, wherever you end up, just do great work and it'll take time to get busy. But you'll be plenty busy. I want to do less surgery, not more.
That's so true. I think it's a great philosophy. I think patients find the good doctors no matter what. Like if you just, every patient you treat, just try to do the best, you know, get the best possible result. That patient tells two, those two tell two other, and it just becomes exponential. And it's just delivering, you know, on each case that you do. And I think you know, you're right. It's a good way to look at it. Don't worry about the volume. It'll be there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I tell patients too, I said, for this surgery, I'm giving you exactly the treatment that I'd want from you. So you don't have to worry. But are you doing this? Are you doing this? I'm using exactly what I'd want from my own eye for every step.
That's awesome.
I assure you it is the absolute best of the best of the best because that's all I want for my own eyes.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. You're right.
Yeah, and patients, I think it's such an amazing time to be an ophthalmologist. I think it's just, you know, such a blessing for us. I'm like you about the same time. I finished my residency in 2000 and I didn't do a formal fellowship either. But as you can see now, I'm still doing a fellowship. I'm doing a lifelong fellowship. I learn every day.
Right. That's so true.
So no, all neat stuff. I think where we're heading in our field is going to be amazing. I think we're seeing it now for sure. Combining lenses, I think, are coming. The adjustability of lenses or swappability is coming. I do like that idea. That makes a lot of sense to me to not be locked in forever.
Right.
And then I also think we're in the OR. I think we're going to get robotic cataract surgery. I mean, this is coming.
You're right. There's you probably know, I saw the presentation from the guy out in California.
JP Hubschman at Horizon Surgical.
Yes.
I'm actually involved with the company. So that's my deal. I'm already involved.
That's awesome. Well, congrats on that. If you would have asked me 2 years ago, I said, there's no way. I just wouldn't believe it. I don't think it would have been possible. And then I saw the presentation and had a chance to kind of have a Zoom call with JP and it was I thought, oh my gosh, like I legit started thinking like I might be replaced. I would never have thought I'd be replaced by a robot, but then when
it's like a plane with autopilot. I mean, you're basically, a surgeon will supervise it, but maybe in the future a surgeon can supervise. Maybe I can look at a screen and supervise four robots at once.
Totally. Yeah, I think it's possible. I never would have thought so, but when I saw the tech, it's sort of like driving, you know, with an autopilot with a, you know, Tesla. You know, you never would have thought, you know, now we're doing it. So
yeah, and it'll get better and better. I think 10 years from now, you'll have a really truly self-driving car, way better than we have now with even the best Teslas. But I think it's coming. And the other neat thing too is just like if you think of for human vision, I can process 25, maybe 30 frames a second. If I show you a YouTube video at 25 frames a second, you see it as very fluid. 30 frames a second for sure. 60 frames a second, it's like beyond fluid. It's so perfect.
Right.
But you can have like real-time devices like OCTs measuring the position of like the posterior capsule hundreds of times a second.
Yeah.
And so, and then with a reaction time far faster than a human.
Yeah. So we should.
Yeah. It's coming.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's the key. I think we're always searching. I always say that the driving forces for innovation are safety and efficacy. And you know, we're always trying to get better results and safer results. And if that, you know, robotic is going to certainly, if it can trump on the safety, you know, and just eliminate, you know, capsule tears, you know, complications, you know, and then obviously, you know, things like AI and all that stuff to, you know, improve efficacy, you know, we'll just keep driving those things forward. And I see it's the future. You're right.
Yeah, especially for routine cases. You know, 90%+ of your cases are basically routine. So obviously for the tougher cases with the small pupil with the sneaky and this, maybe that's not quite the robot's, you know, wheelhouse just yet. Maybe that's still for you as a surgeon.
Right.
But I think it's going to be still, we're still in control of it. We're still controlling it. That's I think the last kind of pillar we're going to have in the future is obviously integration of more AI stuff. So as you know, I've been involved with AI and lens calcs for a long time now. And I think that's really starting to come to fruition. And we're seeing results that are just, you know, really quite impressive, much better than we've ever had before. So I think those three things, accommodating lenses, I think robotic cataract surgery, and then I think AI, more involved in ophthalmology is what's coming from in my perspective.
Well said. Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. So if you had to bet, those are good horses to bet on for sure. That's going to lead us forward.
Yeah. And then again, we still have that growing population here in the US, growing amount of need for our services, and we still have so few residency spots. They used to be like 400 something. Now it's slightly increased to 500 spots nationwide. We just had the ophthalmology match last week.
Yes.
And so it's, I think it's a great time to be an ophthalmologist. And if anything, we need to train more of us.
Totally agree. You're right. It's interesting. I think we do have, you know, this looming sort of volume problem that's coming over our head. And, you know, just to see as those baby boomers hit, at the same time, we're having a number of baby boomers, you know, sort of leave the workforce. We're sort of, I think, I forget the stat, but it's something like every year we get 500 new ophthalmologists, but I think every year we have like two times or three times that retire. So it's sort of like, yeah, we're going upside down and the volume's going up. So something's got to give. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll become more and more efficient. I think that'll be an amazing thing. And maybe they'll expand training programs more, but obviously great time to do ophthalmology. And listen, get your, the Wiley Bofna protocol up there for fellowship year and like the curriculum. I'm telling you, it'd be an amazing resource. It'd be so widely, or get together with other similar practices, maybe with the RSA and put something together. I think it'd be amazing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. A friend of mine, you know, Rob Weinstock's got a very similar fellowship. And, you know, we were just down at Caribbean Eye and he had, I think eight of his fellows were there at a, you know, reunion, and we had six of ours there, and it was great, you know, just to see, it's amazing. So just between his practice and ours, we had, you know, 15 people of just this generation. And you're right. Like a lot of the knowledge that just we're creating is just sort of word of mouth getting passed down, but we've got to put it, we got to digitalize it and, you know, put it out there. So.
Yeah. Fantastic. So now we got a good project for you. Inspired by cataract coach. I love it.
Yeah, totally. Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate that.
You're thanking me now, but then next week when you started this, you were like, oh my gosh, the amount of work.
Yeah.
This is so much work to do this, but At the end, I promise it's all worth it. And that's what you recruit the fellows. They'll help you too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I got to, you know, I've got to be better at delegating some of that. Exactly. Part of the deal is, all right, you got to do this chapter, this portion, you know, yeah, join the team. Yeah. This is your job here. Yeah.
Oh, you'll get it done, I'm sure. Well, Bill, it was a pleasure talking to you. I've loved being your colleague for 20 years. We kind of think the same way in so many different topics here. And I'm really excited what you're doing with your fellowship and training the next generation and with your new foray into social media. Keep it up.
Thanks, Uday. Truly an honor to be on this podcast with you. And the same to you. I appreciate all the stuff you've done. Yeah, the great content that you're putting out there. You really are making an impact on our field. And so it's great to see it. Great to work with you. And thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you. And I want to remind our listeners and our viewers, remember, we got a new podcast every single week. It's on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, YouTube, anywhere you find podcasts, you're going to find it. Just search for Cataract Coach. It'll be there. Also, remember, we got that full curriculum series we talked about on cataractcoach.com. You got to leave YouTube. You got to go to cataractcoach.com. The free PDF book, all the other resources, and of course, there's still a new video every single day. And we will catch you next time.